Enterprise Linux Security is brought to you by TuxCare, a company that helps you modernize your Linux security. Definitely check out TuxCare to see how they can help you automate Linux patching while minimizing downtime, staying compliant, and ensuring business continuity. Check them out at TuxCare.com.
Hello and welcome everyone to Enterprise Linux Security episode 109. How you doing, Joe?
All good. As always, a pleasure being here with you, Jay. And yeah, today we have like the most breaking news we could possibly have. We actually teased this report a couple of episodes back, but we're officially launching the report today. We're making it available today. Just out of the gate, the link to download the full report is on the video description on YouTube. I believe it will be everywhere where this is available. So if you want to follow along, it doesn't require registration. We don't want your email address. Just download the report and have fun with it. It has lots of interesting information, which we'll cover. And yeah, it's not gated at all.
59 pages, if I remember correctly, in this report. And I was browsing through it earlier today and finding some surprising factoids that we'll be getting into, some of which is not surprising. So I think there's going to be a mix of course that's the case, or of course they're doing that, or more, or even worse, of course they're not doing that, as we'll get into. But then there's some, especially when we get into distribution usage percentage. I could just for fun ask people in the live stream, you know, which distributions do you think are in the top three? And then, one is pretty obvious, but the others are kind of surprising, but we'll get into that. And let's just go ahead and do it. So, let's do it.
Okay, so just getting the name of the report here, because I just now realized I didn't mention it before. We're talking about the Enterprise Linux and Open Source Landscape Report 2025. It's a mouthful, but the idea is that we at TuxCare, we create products around supporting older operating systems. We have products around live patching, supporting languages and all of that. And that makes it both interesting and a necessity for us to actually understand the landscape where we're moving. We've been doing this for the past few years now, so we have the ability to look at trends, not just a snapshot of last year. But the idea is that this report covers the state of Linux adoption in the enterprise, the distributions that are being used, the challenges that administrators are facing and companies are facing when using open source and Linux. And it has, like you said, some surprising and some not so surprising. It's the kind of things that, yeah, this obviously had to be this way because people are what you expect them to be, and this is just how things are. The first one, which is pretty obvious if you actually think about it and think about the weight that this distribution had, is that CentOS continues to exist massively in the enterprise, even though it's end of life now. The last CentOS version that was available and supported was officially supported was CentOS 7. It reached end of life in June of 2024, but there are still almost 35% of organizations still using CentOS. This is a bit less than the year before, which was at 39%, almost 40%, but it's still a massive amount of companies and organizations using CentOS, even though it's no longer officially supported.
And I think that goes right in line with what we were talking about last week, where, you know, we were talking about automation. And if your distribution, your primary choice, goes in a direction that your company just can't follow along with for whatever reason, no disrespect to those distributions, but if the direction changes and it's not your direction, then you could be forced to make a decision. Do you convert everything over to that distribution? Do you even have time to do that with your workload? Probably not. And it's one thing with my automation system where I built in multiple distributions from the very beginning. However, most people don't do that. They just think, you know, their distribution's always going to be there or just always going to be the way that it is. And then when you deal with CentOS having changed, then you have organizations that are making the decision, do we do the workload to migrate to something else, or do we find a way to keep it going longer? And a lot of people are trying to either make it go longer or worse, just not doing anything at all and just leaving it as is and being a sitting duck, which is what we're seeing in the report.
As always, this is always about cost. And last episode, we talked about automation and the hassle that it is when you have to switch distributions and you have to change your scripts and adjust all the tooling that you have. But it actually goes beyond all of this. You don't expect your distribution to actually die the way that CentOS died. You don't expect, for example, Ubuntu to stop existing next year or 2 years from now. So you have Ubuntu today, you assume that there will always be a pass forward, there will always be an upgrade available, you will always have some version to which you can migrate. And the way that this happened with CentOS was that at that point when Red Hat made the announcement, you had NASSync. There were alternatives that sprung up afterwards, but at the time that the announcement was made, you had absolutely nothing to migrate to. So there might have been some type of blockage here, which prevented people from actually considering and planning properly for how to approach this problem. But changing your entire infrastructure overnight, it's not something that happens. And this is not just about distributions. This happens with everything, applications, training, everything. You don't just change the way that you have your infrastructure set up just because something changed. So people continue to run CentOS. In fact, those 35% that I mentioned that are still running CentOS, about half of those are still running either CentOS 6 or CentOS 8. CentOS 6 has been out of support for how many years now? 4 or 5 years? And yeah, companies are still running it. And yeah, there are, and I'm not kidding here, I'm not exaggerating here, but there are thousands of vulnerabilities that affect CentOS 6. If you don't have any source of support for CentOS 6 and you still have still have systems running CentOS 6, you have thousands of vulnerabilities that affect those systems. That's massive.
Yep. It really is. And it's, you know, it's just a matter of time before we, you know, this keeps on going. Obviously, it's going to keep on going this way. It's part of the reason why we see companies, you know, in the news. It's like, okay, who's the victim this week? You know, who got breached this week or ransomware this week? And it's a sad thing that a lot of companies have to learn the lesson the hard way. But to be fair, you know, earlier in my career worked at companies where you so much as mention upgrade or patch or change of distribution, and you could watch everyone's smiles in the room just go, you know, like, oh my gosh, the anxiety goes up. And then the mentality is, okay, what's going to break when we do this? And then, you know, everything's working fine right now. Our customers are happy. Their website's running fast. It has been fine the last year, so what could possibly happen? And then they, you know, something does happen, and then they have much more money to spend to fix and rectify a situation than presumably they would have had if they migrated to another platform. And then, as we'll talk later, it's also about, you know, when they do change platforms, where are they going? And that's in the report. It tells us this. And that's pretty important as well, because, you know, where do you go from here? But then far too often we have people that just stay where they are, and, you know, it's just not good.
About 42% plan to have some type of extended lifecycle support. Again, we at Texier, we offer that. And another 42% plan to migrate to other distributions. The ones that are planning to migrate, they will have to bite the bullet and they will have to do the work and support all of those changes going forward.
Right.
Surprisingly, the rest, because this doesn't add up to 100%, the others, almost 13%, they want to continue running CentOS without any support. So they know they're at risk, they expect to be at risk, and they will do nothing about it. And we'll touch back on this subject further along, but this is probably the worst position that you can be in as a sysadmin. When you have systems that you know that are vulnerable, you have no recourse, you have no ability to fix the problems, and you're told that you need to continue to run those systems. That's the most stressful position that you can be in as a sysadmin, at least from my point of view.
It's true. I've run into that a lot where, you know, and I feel like it's often the case, probably the majority of the time, where system administrators understand this. They understand what end of life means. They understand what happens when you run these. But if you have a CTO that's not very tech savvy, for example, it can often be hard to do the right thing. It's not enough sometimes that you want to do the right thing and you know what the right thing to do happens to be, but you have to get the buy-in from your team or your company to make a, you know, drastic change. And it's sometimes hard when they don't understand what could happen to sign off on a maintenance window or, you know, period of time of testing to make that happen. So it can be really frustrating for system administrators to not be able to do the right thing just because they're shot down when they ask. And then when things fall over, then they have to work nights and weekends just to fix it. And they're probably thinking, well, if they would have listened to me, I wouldn't be working this particular weekend. But I want to make sure we're not coloring this, and we're not. Just as an aside, that, you know, system administrators are making bad choices. You know, some of them do, but I think often it's just the bureaucracy of everything that sometimes gets in the way and makes it harder for system administrators to do what they need to do. And having that resistance can add frustration to the job.
And of course, we ask the follow-up question there. If you're willing to migrate, where are you intending to go to? What's the distribution that you're going to go for? And the majority are predominantly going to stay within the RHEL ecosystem. And again, for the same reasons that we mentioned at the start. It's the direction that requires the least amount of change from your end. So right. Your tooling will probably require the least amount of changes, if any. You have some choices now, like Alma Linux and Rocky. You can go read the report and check the preferences. I'll give you the top there. But again, Alma Linux is well positioned. Rocky is well positioned. RHEL itself is well positioned. But another interesting thing there, and about those specific results, if you add up all the free distributions, they still make up the majority of the RHEL ecosystem. We touched on this at the time when RHEL announced that they were changing the way that CentOS would work with CentOS Stream. And one of the things that we discussed at the time was that RHEL amounted to a minority of the actual RHEL ecosystem. They are not the majority by any means. The free options are. And the way that RHEL approached this, they were shooting themselves in the foot because they might make the entire ecosystem less useful for them. The free alternatives are making up for that, and they are making up for that significantly. You should look at these numbers for no other reason, just to look at how the ecosystem actually looks like from the enterprise perspective.
And the response was incredible. I mean, it was pretty much right away that you had alternatives being mentioned as, you know, being worked on and going to exist. You know, Alma Linux and Rocky stepped up, hey, we're going to do this thing. And they did it. And it wasn't that they, you know, it wasn't like Unity, how some people wanted to keep that desktop environment alive and then they didn't. But when it comes to enterprise Linux, you know, everyone stepped up and they got the job done. And, you know, I think that's one of the most incredible things about open source. It's just, you know, the people that step up and build something new out of it. So, it's kind of humorous to me, you know, Red Hat wanted to more tightly control the market here, and they just ended up creating more competitors.
Yeah, that's an intended consequences right there. Yep. Moving on to cybersecurity incidents. So the year before, we had about half the respondents saying that their company had suffered a cybersecurity incident on the year previous. So that was referring to 2023. On this report, that number actually lowered. About 40% of the organizations reported that they suffered a cybersecurity incident. 60% of the ones that did suffer a breach, they reported that this was linked to having a patch available but not applied, meaning that they had the solution to the problem, but they, for some reason, could not apply that solution. This ties directly into what I was saying before. It's that awful situation where you're in, where you're seeing your systems having this vulnerability or that vulnerability or being affected, potentially affected by a given exploit, and not being allowed to fix it and to solve the problem. And again, having been in that position, the stress that it is going back to work every single day and knowing that your systems could have been hacked overnight, and not trusting your systems anymore if some actual hacker that knows their things actually got in and got access and you have no way of telling if that actually happened or not. Again, incredibly, incredibly stressful position.
It is. I think far too many of us have been there. I've had situations where even getting a disk replaced in a RAID array was a chore to get approval for. And that's a situation where if you're doing it right, sure, it's going to lower performance while it, you know, repropagates everything. But I've had situations where even that was hard to get, and everyone else too. And you're right. It's not, you know, as a system administrator, you know what could happen, and you know what the ingredients are to make something bad happen. And when those ingredients are there, and you're thinking, just like you said, I don't know, I'm a little nervous here, especially considering, you know, the security industry turnaround could be quite high, because you'll have someone or a company that's breached, and then they fire the security person, and at no fault of their own. I mean, even with the best security team on the planet, I mean, it's a tug of war match between security and threat actors. So often, you know, you're with an employer that doesn't fully understand, you know, what could happen. And, you know, the fact that there's no 100% security, it just doesn't exist. And it's just, yeah, stressful. It really is.
There's a disconnect between vulnerability awareness and actually the remediation for those problems. The biggest factors contributing to this were the main one was communication. Some organizations just communicate among teams using stuff like emails and spreadsheets. They don't have tooling specifically designed to do that. Others at about 29%, the ones before were 32%. Another major reason for not being able to patch on time is the inability to take critical systems offline. We all know that. You cannot take down the web servers. You cannot take down the database during sales period. This is peak sales. You cannot shut down those systems. We need the sales to come in. We need business activities to come in. You cannot stop that just because there's this vulnerability that might be exploited. We've all heard that before. Another factor there is human error. They know about it. Maybe it got lost in the communication. Maybe somebody forgot to apply a patch when it was available. That's also a big factor here in still suffering from these problems.
Right. Yeah.
Then another thing that we asked, last year we had this big incident in security. We recapped them on episode during the first episode of the year, I believe. We had the XC incident, we had CrowdStrike, we had the United Health. There were lots of incidents last year that were really, really major. So some things that we asked about was how that affected companies, because some things at that scale, they have to have an impact, and we believe it had an impact, and we asked people about it. So the XC incident had widespread awareness. About 83.6% of the respondents were familiar with it, which is pretty good, considering that this was a problem at the open source project management level, meaning that at its core, it was just about managing one specific open source project among millions of them, and still a majority of people were aware of it. And again, just a recap, this was probably a state-sponsored situation. This was a massive operation that lasted for many years until it resulted the way it did. It had the end result that it did. It was caught completely by accident, completely by chance. And the end result was a backdoor on every single Linux system worldwide. The scope of this is incredible. This caused that about 70% of organizations reviewed their open source supply chain processes, the way that they vet new stuff that they bring in, the way that they vet the new applications that they deployed, the new tooling that they bring in. So this forced a significant change in the way that the organizations look at the open source supply chain. Really, really striking that so many actually changed the way that they did things.
I'm happy to see that. I just wish it wasn't for, you know, such a bad reason. I would love it if, you know, everyone woke up in the morning and decided to care, and for no other reason that they just decide to care about it. But it often is the case that, you know, it takes something bad to happen for people to, you know, pay attention to it.
So the most common actions that companies took here were about specifically conducting training on secure programming practices, which is always great. More than half did that. increasing use of security tools, things to check dependencies in projects to make sure that you have full visibility on what your tools are bringing in, and addressing software bill of materials. This is actually a pretty nice concept, and it's unfortunately that we might actually phase out SBOMs before we actually use them properly, because there are already other tools being brought in to do the same thing, and I don't know if... Again, I know exactly why this is changing. It's because some of the big names in the industry are not really compelled to using SBOMs when they have their own in-house solutions, and walled gardens are a thing here also in Linux for some reason. Again, I digress here. But it's really, really interesting that a problem at this scope that affects just an open source management project, it's really interesting the widespread impact that it was. I mean, CrowdStrike had a great impact, but we all knew about CrowdStrike from watching CNN. You didn't have to be aware about open source stuff. You didn't have to pay attention to Linux or the Linux ecosystem at all to know about it. This was such a niche thing, and it had such an impact. This was massive. And yeah, that really surprised me that it had the reach that it did.
I haven't seen blue screen of death trend as much since Windows 98 came out. So it's kind of, you know, but everybody at this point, it's kind of like, you know, everybody was experiencing this, even if they're not working in information technology. You could have, you know, a sales manager in the drive-thru at Burger King getting a Whopper, and then the order window has a blue screen, or someone at the airport trying to find out what time their flight is leaving just to see a blue screen of death on the airport, you know, display where it shows all that. So everywhere you look, you know, there's a blue screen of death or something like that. And, you know, even someone who's not technically inclined might say, well, what is that? And then at least one person in the crowd is going to know what that is and educate them. But in, you know, as we're going to see, it's like the patching processes, you know, they take that into account, which I'd like that. But I just, you know, obviously wish that didn't happen, because of the amount of money that it cost the industry was staggering, the amount of, you know, money that caused. So that's, I wish it wasn't the case, but, you know, a lot of people, we learned the hard way, but we need these testing practices to really understand, you know, what could happen and to try to harden our systems and make them more resilient.
Actually, the CrowdStrike incident surprised me the other way around. For the XE, it was surprising how many people were aware of it. For the CrowdStrike one, I was surprised that not 100% of the respondents said that they were aware of it. Only 87.7% said that they were. And again, you didn't even have to work in IT to be aware of this incident. You didn't even have to be paying attention at any specific website or news channel to be facing the problem. But still, this surprised me the other way around. Like you said, billions in losses, and more than half of the organizations, they reviewed the way that they do their patch testing methodology, which is great. Any type that we review, the way that we're used to those things, it's really good, because not just you're addressing that specific problem that caused you to review the processes, but in the time that between when you adopted a specific way to do things. And today, things have changed, and things in IT change like every other day. If you're only revising your processes like every year or every 3 or 4 or 5 years, like say, I always use maintenance windows to apply patches, and you only revise that if ever, like every 5 years or so, there are better ways to do things. So even if it was because something like as serious as this happened, causing half the organizations to face and change the way that they approach this, that's really good.
$5.4 billion in debt, as I understand it, from the report. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of money in losses. It was $5.4 billion in the Fortune 500 companies. That's a massive cost that caused. But they get that Uber Eats gift card though, so that's fine, right? I joke, but seriously, it caused a lot of people to, you know, work over. I keep saying that, but it's part of life. You know, anytime we have breaking news on this podcast, I wonder how many people that are listening think of it like, oh, more work to do.
Okay, so the biggest changes here were the inclusion of rollback plans. Surprisingly, not many companies had rollback plans in their patching operations, which is surprising if you're used to always having to get approval to do something. When you ask for that approval, you usually have to provide the rollback plan. But apparently, the majority of organizations didn't have that, at least in an official way, and now they do, and that's great. Broadening the testing scope is also great, means that you have larger lab environments, you have better lab environments, if that's the case. But again, really a good improvement as well. And establishing formal processes. It's not just, hey, Joe, we need to update 10 servers today. And that gets written nowhere and nobody actually checks if they were updated or not. Formalizing stuff, having stuff written down. You don't need that for the home lab. You don't need that if it's just you and someone else working on the small shop on the corner. But as soon as you get to the enterprise level of things, you have hundreds of people, thousands of people working in the company, you need the processes formalized. You need to be able to look a thing up, something up when someone new comes into the team, or you need to do something in a hurry. You can't rely just on your muscle memory to know stuff. You need to have stuff written down. That's a must. Unfortunately, you only realize that you don't have it when you need it. So having the ability to create this type of formal processes before you actually need them, this is great.
I've only worked with one company that had a rollback plan as part of its normal process of implementing something or migrating. And they did it right. Like, what I really liked about the way that they did it was it wasn't enough to have the rollback steps. I mean, that was requirement number one. But requirement number two was to qualify for whatever it is you wanted to do. You have to have the rollback steps, and you had to have cloned the production instance into a testing environment and go through the steps in your implementation plan. And then immediately after that, go back through the rollback steps. So that way, you know, when you come to the table to your manager with everything, you know, it's basically understood. You tested this by cloning the production instance into an isolated test environment that is not publicly available. And that became the culture, which I really liked, where anytime someone was like, well, what's going to happen if we install this, or what's going to happen if we make this tweak, to which the reply was, well, clone the instance into a test environment and you tell me what's going to happen and let me know what the results are. And when I first started working with that company, at first they didn't have that, but it only took a few bad migrations before that policy came into play, and they stuck with it. And that's, in my opinion, the right way to do it. A testing environment paired with your steps is definitely a major win, I think.
And that's precisely what I was saying. You only do that when you have the problem. You only change the processes when you're faced with a situation. In this case, companies are doing that proactively. They're not waiting to be affected by something. And the incident itself, the awareness that was created around the incident, made companies take the right decisions, even if they were forced by the situation, but they didn't directly experience the problem. Again, good outcome from a pretty bad situation. Overall, all of these situations, they actually caused a diminishing confidence in open source component security. Only about 12.31% are very confident that their open source components are up to date and secure. This is about half of the confidence level that they showed the year before, where 23.81% were confident. And the ones that are not very confident increased from 24.6% to 40%. This is a direct result from the complexity of the environment. You have lots of dependencies, you have lots of different toolings, lots of different projects, and it's really, really tricky to vet everything correctly every single time. So as people get more aware of the amount of different toolings and different projects that they're relying on, they start to understand the full picture of, yeah, I'm not really that secure. If I have to keep these tools always up to date and always on the latest version, be aware of all the vulnerabilities they have, there's just not enough hours in the day to be able to do that.
Yeah, it really worries me more when someone says, I have 100% confidence in my security or something, because usually that's overconfidence. It's, but yeah, the confidence level is very important to take a look at too. And 12.31%, that's kind of low.
That's the no plan crowd from when we tease this. They're very confident and they have no plan on how to manage the open source security, which again, no plan, but who cares? It's great.
Yeah, it's not even just-in-time security. It's like after
what security.
What security? Yeah, like security, we don't do that here.
Okay, something else that everybody knows about is that the AI technology benefits are perceived. People know that it's really great. It's the best thing since bread came sliced, but apparently it's falling short of expectations. It's that graph that probably everybody has seen at this time. It's at this moment, which is the value of expectations and the trough of disappointment. People are really expecting really good things, and then when they actually see the tools in play and what they're going to do with them, it doesn't really quite add up to that. So most organizations reported a moderate improvement in workflow or productivity from using AI-powered software. This is slightly up, 59% the year before. And the ones that report significant improvement decreased from 25% to just 18%. The ones that say that there's no noticeable change, they're around the same. It's about 40%, meaning that, yeah, we're using AI, but it's as if we didn't use AI because there's really no change about it. The main shift here in regards to AI adoption is that innovation is still the top priority, but cost reduction, the expectation of reducing costs by using AI, that just almost doubled. It went from 35% to 50-something%, meaning that, yeah, we want to innovate, It's all about doing the next great thing and finding the... No, it's really not. It's about saving costs. If we can fire some people because we have AI software, great, because we'll be reducing costs even more. They're just saying the quiet part out loud now.
Yeah, it's artificial insanity, as I like to call it, which, by the way, there's an artificial insanity t-shirt on the merch store if you're interested, if you feel like I feel about AI, but I'm going to not get into a rant about it and stick to the facts. But and the thing, and speaking of facts, I've been using AI a little bit more often, but not like a lot. It's kind of often, I learned this trick from you, where I ask AI for code, and then I have to ask AI to check its own code. And it's kind of funny whenever it finds problems with it. And it'll literally say, you're right, there is an issue in this function. Here's a new version. And then you get the new version. And I've often found lately that that working with AI, it's better when you ask for individual functions one at a time, because once you describe like an entire program and what it does, it gets it wrong. But if you know you need a function that does X, Y, and Z, then you can ask it for just that function. But even then, you might run into issues. And the accuracy about this is just not there yet. I almost feel like in some ways, we adopted AI a little too soon. I think like there's all this buzz about it and excitement around it. And then it just, every company and their mother is now, offering their AI solution. You have browsers that have AI built in and code editors that have it built in. It's like we're rolling out a beta at this point, in my opinion.
We're beta testers and we're paying for it.
Right.
Another thing that's interesting and probably to be expected, because again, this is something that we know from working with Linux. Every single distribution, even though they're all Linux distributions, they're all running essentially the same kernel and more or less the same tooling, they will be promoted and have some special tweaks and some special sauce to be better at doing some specific function more than others. Maybe it's better at web hosting. Maybe it's better at raw mass calculations. Maybe it's better at AI. Maybe it's faster at doing something specific that you actually need. So one of the myths that goes around is that organizations were going to have just one single distribution across their entire fleet. And no, that's not really the case. The majority of companies, they have multiple distribution environments. The reason why this is important is that when you're considering where to acquire your support from and where you need your support agreements from, if you have multiple vendors to buy from, your administrative team is going to complain that they have to manage lots of different contracts at the same time. They have to discuss with lots of different vendors. They have to go into legal agreements with multiple vendors and multiple third parties and all of that. So having those many distributions in your environment was often something that people joked about. Nah, we're not handling that. We just have CentOS. We just have Ubuntu. All of our systems are running the same thing. And they're not. Organizations are running multiple distributions precisely because some are better tailored at specific jobs than others. And they are using them to their fullest extent that they can. So people are not essentially dumb, so they will know about it. They will use the best tool for the job in every given occasion. And it's interesting that this goes against what many people just parrot. And you can find lots of examples of this, of people just saying, oh, just use this single distribution. You only need one type of tooling, one specific set of scripts, and everything will work just fine, and it will all be magical and great. And that's not really the case in the real world.
I think every company I've worked with used at least two distributions. And sure, the first one was their primary and probably, I don't know, I'm guessing 75% of their hardware and virtual machines, but there's always that use case. I worked at a company once that had an SD card cloner, and they actually needed SD cards because they were provisioning GPS units, and it only worked on SUSE Enterprise. So they had like one Enterprise or SUSE Enterprise distribution in the corner attached to a SD card cloner. And I've seen people use a certain distribution because it works with a label maker. I mean, I've seen all kinds of things, and it's very, very common. And you're right. It's not the case that one distribution is going to fit everyone. It might fit even most sometimes, but you know, there's a reason why distro hopper is still a trending term within my audience, and it's never going to stop. You know, I should stop being a distro hopper. No, maybe you should accept the fact that, you know, not any one distribution is going to do all the things that you want. That's just the way life is, unfortunately. But every company, like I said, that I worked with used at least two.
What you just mentioned there, hardware support, is actually one of the reasons why changing away from a given distribution is pretty hard. You will have to test the new distribution to see if it still supports the hardware that you're using. Maybe it breaks your label printer. Maybe it breaks your 3D scanner. Maybe it breaks the CT scan where it's installed. There are lots of reasons why people are stuck on distributions. There are lots of reasons why people are still stuck with very old distributions. And hardware support is actually one of those reasons, and it's very high there in the list.
Yeah, I also see... I'm not sure how often this is, but I see it every now and then where the distribution is using what I call a Franken kernel, where you have Linux kernel version X and it doesn't support, you know, because some distributions stick to older kernels for stability purposes. But since a lot of the drivers are built into the kernel, then it doesn't support a brand new server that you bought from Dell, HP, or whoever you bought it from. But then the distribution will backport driver updates from future versions of the Linux kernel into the current one. And then, you know, you have version 5 or version 6 of the Linux kernel, but it's not quite the same thing if you were to download the source code and compile it yourself. And a lot of work goes into hardware compatibility. It's not that distributions will just take a kernel and leave it as is. Sure, some do, but a lot of them, and Ubuntu is a good example of this, they'll start backporting fixes, but you know, security fixes and driver updates right into their stack from future versions in order to maintain an older kernel. So it's hardware support is huge. And I've seen people that have given up on Linux because it doesn't support their hardware, but then the kernel is from like 2 years ago and their computer just came out last week. You know, what do you expect? It's actually not easy, and it is a burden.
And actually, when you have very expensive and very niche hardware like medical devices, like specific robotics equipment that have out-of-kernel drivers that you need to compile against a specific version of the kernel, that's another major factor where you're stuck with the given version and distribution. You can't just change the kernel because it will require you to also change the tooling, so you need to keep the tooling at the specific version to make sure that it still compiles correctly and you can load the modules and you can get your equipment to work. Sometimes people don't realize this, but there are lots of reasons why you have to be with older versions of Linux, because again, it's really, really expensive either to replace the hardware just because you're updating your Linux distribution or just getting it to continue to run. This is especially true of medical equipment, for example.
And you'll see this in the release notes for distributions often, or even just open discussions that distributions will have, where they'll literally have a conversation like, we're thinking about deprecating this network card or that video card because it's too old to maintain it. And then you get into a situation where you update from one distribution to another and find out that something, you know, used to work and doesn't, and you have older hardware. I see that a lot. I remember early in my career, near the very beginning, the company I worked for, we ordered a server. It was brand new from Dell. I was really excited about it. So I rack it, and then I start installing Debian, and Debian complains, you have no network card. I'm like, what do you mean? There's a network card right there. I can touch it. I have visual evidence of the presence of a network card. And then Debian's like, you don't have one. I'm like, oh, okay. So what do? Use Debian testing, which, you know, ultimately did support it, but I don't want to run testing in production. So, you know, do I just use Debian backports to pull in a newer kernel? And I mean, this is, we go through this. It's one of those things that I think not a lot of people talk about, but people, system administrators run into this like literally all the time.
The joys of digging up 3COM NICs, because those were the only ones that Red Hat Linux version 2 or 3 supported, and you had to install it in floppies. Yeah, those were the days. Okay, just the final point that I want to bring up with the report here. There's, again, this obvious award that everybody was expecting. The time spent on maintenance windows scales with the infrastructure size. Ta-da, everybody knows that. The more servers you have, the more time you need to spend doing maintenance on them. However, and here's the catch and why this is actually interesting. For very large infrastructure sizes, we're talking about thousands of servers. When you're using live patching, and this is obviously a question that's very relevant for us at TuxCare, it doesn't scale like that. You go up to a certain size, and then you start using live patching, and then the time stays constant. It doesn't really matter that you have more servers, because you're going to take the same amount of time to patching them. It's not disruptive, right. So you don't have to interrupt your services, and it's easier to do. And we have the graphs and the results for both cases, with and without live patching. Again, another interesting result that you should check out. It stops scaling with your fleet size. Your infrastructure can grow, but your maintenance operation time does not have to grow with it. It doesn't grow with it. And we have evidence there on the results, which is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, live patching is magic to me. Like, it's just like ripping the tablecloth off a table without having any of the dinnerware fall to the floor. I mean, it's essentially what you're doing. You're taking something that's running and you're implementing a patch right into running code, which, you know, if you would have asked me 20 years ago, I would say that's impossible and that'll never happen. But it's happening and it's here and we have it. And something I definitely would like to see more people use. I use it. I don't use it personally in lieu of rebooting. I still reboot regularly my servers because my mentality has always been, you know, if someone can't access learnlinux.tv for 5 minutes, I'm not going to lose any sleep over that. If I have to reboot it, I reboot it. But the reason why I do that is because I feel like live patching kind of gives you an immediate benefit from a patch rather than you reboot the system and then benefit. If you're scheduled to reboot a system a week from now, 2 weeks from now, but the patch is out today, then you can have that patch today, benefit from it today. And then at some point, if you need to reboot later on, or maybe you won't because you won't need to in that case, but you'll make that determination as a system administrator. But regardless of what your policy is on rebooting, it gives you that ability to benefit from it right now because, you know, threat actors aren't waiting. There's no code of honor where I need to wait for that company to reboot their servers just to make sure that, you know, I'm giving them an opportunity. No, if the vulnerability is there right now, they're going to leverage that right now. They're not going to wait. Neither should we.
And yeah, we covered some of the points on the Enterprise Linux and Open Source Landscape report. Again, the link is in the description. It's not gated. You don't have to enter your email. You don't have to give us anything to access it. There's just a download button and you get the PDF there.
Yep.
because somebody was talking about this on the chat, and we were actually not going to raise the subject since the episode is already running long, but somebody talked about these specific vulnerabilities, and they are relevant, they are making the news. So there are two vulnerabilities around OpenSSH. These ones didn't get fancy names, which is amazing. It's CV-2025-26465 and 466. Just to give you the rundown here, the one that ends in 465 affects OpenSSH clients with Verify Host Key DNS enabled. It affects versions from 6.8p1 to 9.9p1. And the other one, CVE-2025-26466, affects both clients and servers, versions 9.5p1 up to 9.9p1. The first vulnerability has existed since December 2014, which is a very long time ago. The second one was introduced in August of 2023. The first vulnerability allows for a man-in-the-middle attack, meaning that somebody that can eavesdrop into your connection pass can actually pretend to be the server, intercept your handshake, and then intercept the connection, look at the traffic, and pass it along to the server. And there's no way for you to know that that is happening. FreeBSD systems. And again, somebody was asking about FreeBSD. Why not use FreeBSD? FreeBSD systems were particularly vulnerable to this, as they had the Verify Host Key DNS enabled option for about 10 years, actually since before this vulnerability was introduced. So there is this window of about 9.5 years since the FreeBSD started coming with this by default enabled and being vulnerable to this. The denial of service could just be weaponized to prevent administrative access to specific systems.
Yep.
The mitigation strategy here, you need to upgrade to OpenSSH 9.9p2, which is the latest version, and it's the recommended solution. You can actually try to work around this by setting Verify Host Key DNS to off. That would mitigate the first one. And you can work with login grace time, max startups, and per source penalties, which are all options on SSHD, and configure those to very low values so that you can punish the ones that are trying to do this. Again, updating OpenSSH right now, it's a very good idea. If you have systems running OpenSSH, of course you do, all of them have it. You really need to go look at the updates that you have available and patch to the latest version.
And I'm going to give everyone a quick OpenSSH update tip that I think is important, because considering that a lot of people work remotely and they're not within driving distance of the server, they lock themselves out. So the way I recommend to do it is to have two terminal windows open. And the first one, you have an SSH connection to the server that you're updated. The second one, while your first terminal window is still connected to SSH, because even if you restart SSH, it's not going to drop a concurrent connection. So your connection in that first window will still be there. In the second window, make another SSH connection to that same server just to make sure that you still can, because that way you're testing whether or not you're going to get locked out. Because the problem is, if you have just one terminal window open, you open SSH, you update it, and then you close the window, then you find out you can't get into it because of a configuration error. So I always recommend to have two terminal windows. The first, you maintain that connection. The second one, you're just testing to see whether you still can connect. So that way you're a lot less likely to lock yourself out. So that's a bonus tip for everyone.
And I guess that concludes our episode for today. Thank you everybody who joined. As always, it was a pleasure. Go check out the report. There's lots of interesting things there. Like Jay said, it's almost 60 pages, but there's lots of pictures, so it's not all just a wall of text. Right. That's lots of useful information there. It gives you a better understanding of your environment and everybody else's so that you can see how you stack up against them. Sometimes we don't have an accurate depiction of that. We always play this picture in our minds where everybody is doing everything fine except us. That's not the case. It's not really like that. Take a look. Link is in the description. I'm sure Jay will appreciate this. Leave a like and a subscribe if you do.
Yes.
And until the next one.
Thank you guys so much for watching and or listening. We appreciate it, and we'll see you next time.